Well, thank you very much. Coming from Scotland, a nearly independent country, it's a long way, which is why it's taken me a long time, not lack of will, because it's lovely to be in Cambridge. I was, in fact, at school in Cambridge. I arrived, suddenly realised on the train coming here, I arrived 50 years ago with a broad Devonshire accent, and I left 40 years ago with this bland accent. So Cambridge did bad things to me. And Cambridge has clearly changed in the interim. As I walked here, I walked past what was my favourite restaurant as a child, which was the Varsity restaurant, and if you know it, it's on St Andrew Street. And what was wonderful about it when I was a child is you could have spaghetti and chips. For me, as a 10-year-old, this was the height of sophistication. I looked very carefully, and I don't think you can have spaghetti and chips anymore. So Cambridge is not necessarily changed for the better. But as Alison says, the reason why I'm here is because 2 years ago we were at this pretentiously named transformative research pitch to peers. It's a sort of Dragon's Den version of academic funding, where you have to stand up and tell people why what you're going to do is going to be of fundamental importance, and you oversell yourself terribly. And my pitch was that I was going to do three things. The things I was going to transform were our understanding of obedience, toxic obedience in particular, crimes of obedience, if you like. Thought I'd get the word crime in since we're in the Institute of Criminology. And more specifically, to look again at our understanding of the Milgram experiments, the Milgram obedience experiments. These are, if you ask psychologists, the most famous studies ever done in psychology. Some of the very few studies in psychology that are known in different disciplines are even known outside of the academic world. So if I speak to audiences of teachers, audiences of police officers, audiences of the military, about two-thirds of them will know of the Milgram studies. Not many studies stand up to that criteria. So that's the first thing I was going to do. The second thing I was going to do was to try and develop new ways of exploring toxic behaviours, because one of the most salient elements of the Milgram studies isn't just what they show, but their profoundly unethical nature. If you Google most unethical psychology studies ever done, you will nearly always find Milgram at or near the top. And the third thing I was going to do was to transform public understanding. I think I probably threw in that I was going to cure cancer and achieve world peace as well, but those were the three things I was going to do in 18 months. And what I'm doing today is standing up before you, a jury of my peers, to try and persuade you that I might have done something, transformed something, or at least raised some debate. So as I say, I'm going to talk about the Milgram studies. But of course, to understand the Milgram studies themselves is important to put them in context. Milgram's impact of our understanding of toxic obedience in many ways comes out of the Holocaust. There's so much Western social thought in the last half century does. And the question of how could it be that so many people were massacred not for anything they'd done, but merely because of the groups to which they belonged and were massacred with either the active connivance or at least the complicity of large swathes of the population. How could that be? And the initial understanding, the initial approach, was a self-evident approach. It was to say that for such monstrous things to happen, the people involved must be monsters. There must be something about them that sets them apart. The enemy without, if you like. Particular types of personality which lead to aggressive, even genocidal types of behaviour. And in psychology, the model that was dominant for many years was the authoritarian personality, actually a very sophisticated model if you read the whole of it, but reduced by post-war social psychology to a very simplistic model of a particular personality type. It predicted, basically, whether you were prone to aggressive hostility against minorities in particular. But two events, which by coincidence happened at exactly the same time, in 1961 changed that understanding, fundamentally transformed our understanding of the human capacity for atrocity, for harming other human beings. One of those was the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem in 1961. Eichmann, the chief bureaucrat of the Holocaust, the man who made the trains run on time to Auschwitz, who was kidnapped by Mossad in Argentina, where he'd been hiding, brought back to Jerusalem and put on trial. And as people sat in that courtroom in 1961 and waited, there was a thrissle. People were going to see the man who was responsible. They were going to see the man who delivered millions to their deaths. They expected to see something truly monstrous. They expected to see the prototypical Nazi. A man perhaps like this. And the shock was that when finally Eichmann entered that courtroom, they didn't see that proud, sneering, sardonic Nazi. They saw an insignificant man. They saw a hunched, fastidious, balding man who looked like any bureaucrat might look, who sat there carefully taking notes, who was the opposite of what was expected. And famously, Hannah Arendt, the German Jewish political philosopher, who was sitting in that courtroom, who wrote dispatches from the courtroom to the New Yorker, who turned those dispatches into Eichmann in Jerusalem, one of the most significant texts of the 20th century, mentioned that Eichmann was not a dangerous and perverted personality, but as terrifyingly normal and characterized by sheer thoughtlessness. Her point was, in many ways, the fact that he seemed ordinary transformed the question in a way that made it even more disturbing. Because if he seemed ordinary, if he seemed like you and me, the question no longer became, what is it about them which makes them capable of these acts, but what is it about us which can make us do these things? What might I do if I was put in this context? The enemy without became the enemy within. The problem was located potentially in any of us. And Arendt sums that up in that redolent phrase, the fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil. Now, she wasn't saying that the acts are banal, of course she was. She was saying that the motives are banal. These are ordinary people acting out of banal motives, wanting to get on, wanting to do their job well, wanting to be efficient bureaucrats. The banality of evil was both an argument that ordinary people can do extraordinary acts of harm, and also a process of count. How do they do it? Through sheer thoughtlessness. Now, I'm not here going to give a seminar on Arendt. And in many ways, I think Arendt has been misrepresented through the way in which her ideas fuse with those of Milgram. Actually, Arendt's thinking and her notion of thoughtlessness is profoundly different from the way the term is used in psychology. And the more I read Arendt, the more I like what Arendt has to say. But what I'm talking about is, if you like, the received understanding. Arendt's ideas become fused with Milgram's, partly, as I said before, out of historical coincidence, because at exactly the same time, in the autumn of 1961, as Eichmann appears in the courtroom in Jerusalem, so Stanley Milgram was carrying out his obedience studies in New Haven at Yale University. Milgram had started off working with Solomon Asch. And Solomon Asch had done a very famous series of studies on conformity, showing that when a series of people say something which is perceptually, self-evidently not true, they lead you to make misjudgments about line length. That people conform. They defy the evidence of their own eyes. Actually, Solomon Asch didn't say that. Again, what was said and what is remembered are different. Asch pointed to the fact that only about a third of the time do people conform, but people were so amazed that people defy the evidence of their own eyes, even when they're a minority at the time, that that became the focus, and people talked about conformity. But Milgram, who in many ways was a brilliant showman as well as a brilliant scientist, wasn't satisfied. He said, look, to show that people conform, they go along with others. Well, something as trivial as judging the comparative length of two lines isn't that exciting. Can we show similar phenomena on something that matters? And he talks about an incandescent moment when he came up with this idea. And this idea was encapsulated in the design of his obedience studies. And this is how they work. You're brought into a laboratory. You're recruited for a study, ostensibly of memory. And when you get to the laboratory, you find another person there, and you are seemingly randomly divided into the role of teacher and learner. It's rigged so that the learner is a confederate of the experimenter, and the real participant is always the teacher. And you're told it's a memory experiment. Teach these people some word pairs, and then test them on those word pairs. And each time they make an error, give them an electric shock. Any subsequent error, increase the level of shock by 15 volts. So you start with something insignificant. 15 volts, 30 volts, 40 volts, 45. My mathematics isn't doing too well this evening. 60, 75, 90. All the way up to 450 volts. You're told these are experiments about the effects of punishment on learning, but the question is, how far will you go? Will you deliver a shock which ostensibly is lethal to somebody for making an error on a learning experiment? And Milgram asks people how far they think they will go. He asks an audience, like you, how far do you think you will go? And most people say, we'll go to about 150 volts. When it starts getting painful, we'll stop around then. Nobody says they'll go beyond about 300 volts. And so he reasons, well, of course people will say I wouldn't do it. So let's ask people what they think others would do. Let's ask experts what they think people will do. He gets a group of psychiatrists. And he asks them, how far do you think people will go in this paradigm? The psychiatrists, the learning psychiatrists, stroke their beards. And they conclude that most people, again, will go to about 150 volts. Very few will go beyond 300 volts. About 1 in 1,000, the extreme psychopath, might go to 450 volts, but these would be people who were inherently disturbed. Most people would not. So what actually happens? What actually happens in this study? Well, the most famous variant of this study, and I'll come back to the fact there are many variants, but the most famous variant, the one that appears in the textbooks, the one that if you were taught this, you were probably taught, is called, sometimes it's called the revised baseline, sometimes it's called the coronary condition. It's basically a condition where you don't sit in the same room as the learner. They're in another room, allegedly getting these shocks. But what you do get is sound, seemingly, conveying to you their reactions. And they start off grunting a bit, and then they shout with pain. And at 150 volts, they talk about a heart condition, and they plead to be let out. How far will most people go? Well, these are the results on that famous new baseline condition. Out of 40 subjects, this is how far people go. 26 out of 40, 65%, go all the way. In effect, if you look to the neighbour either side of you, then 2 out of 3 of you would murder someone for making an error on a psychology experiment. Now, that's a dramatic finding. That's a remarkable finding. That is, to use the obvious pun, a shocking finding. These are results which shocked the world. Yeah.
But not everybody.
No.
Some refused.
Some refused. And I will come back to that. But still, again, what dominates our attention, because our expectation is that nobody will, is that 2/3 of people go the whole way. And Milgram, actually, the interesting thing is, if you look at Milgram's explanations, If you go to the archive, which is in the Stirling Library in Yale, and you can see his notebooks, and it's like, in effect, it's like a blog. Every day he writes two or three comments on it, and he comes up with all sorts of fascinating and rich explanations which has never been in the public domain, and which I will refer to as I talk. But in 1974, he writes his book, 13 years later, he writes his book, Obedience to Authority, the book that has the most impact. And in that, he reverts to a very simple explanation, and he draws on Arendt. This is what he says. Arendt's conception of the banality of evil comes closer to the truth than one might dare to imagine. The ordinary person who shot the victim did so out of a sense of obligation, a conception of his duties as a subject, and not from any peculiarly aggressive tendencies. So again, his explanation, on the surface at least, is almost identical to that of Arendt. And Milgram refers to a state, he calls it the agentic state. It's a misleading term, because he doesn't use agency as most social theorists do. It's a state where you become the agent of somebody else. You become an agent of the experimenter. You're so focused on being a good agent, so focused on doing the bidding of authority, that you hardly notice the victim, hardly notice the consequences of your actions. He suggests there is something in the human psyche which predisposes us towards becoming an agent of authority when in the presence of such an authority. So, between them, Arendt and Milgram form two threads that weave together to form a cord that is stronger than either thread alone, which dominates our explanation of the potential for toxic behaviour of human beings. Not just the Holocaust. The banality of evil, if you look in the newspapers, if you Google it, you will find it used to explain everything from the toxic mis-selling of financial instruments to phone hacking in the mobile newsroom to Rwanda to etc., etc. A really powerful explanation. And one of the problems, one of my motivations for the transformative branch is actually, I would argue, that when you would look within each discipline, people have doubts. When you look at the historians, they have doubts. When you look at the psychologists, they have doubts. But the historians think, well, we can't protest too loudly because the psychological evidence supports it. And the psychologists think, well, you know, we have our doubts, but we can't reject it too strongly because it seems to accord with the historical record. So you get something we call pluralistic ignorance, where everybody believes something that nobody believes because they all believe that somebody else believes it. Really powerful. So let's begin to look at the evidence. Now, I'm going to do something very dangerous, which is I'm going to talk about another discipline. I think all of us are something else marqué. About you. I sometimes think of myself as a historian marqué and enjoy reading history far more than most psychology. But I do so as an amateur, and it's very hard to know the position of texts if you don't know the whole debate. Nonetheless, as I understand it, increasingly historians doubt the simplistic notion of Eichmann and his ilk as somehow mindless automatons simply and mechanically carrying out orders. That in many ways this image of Eichmann should be replaced by this one. And in fact, actually part of the politics of the trial was what image should people see. The prosecution wanted to force Eichmann to wear his uniform, but they realized they couldn't do it. And Eichmann's defense told Eichmann, instructed him, they're going to expect you to be a sardonic monster, so come over as a mild man. Some would argue that Arendt bought Eichmann's self-presentation. But when you look more closely at the evidence on Eichmann, there have been a couple of biographies in the last 10 years. There was Cesarani's in 2004, Stanglitz, which came out to great publicity just last year. They tell a very different story about Eichmann. They make the point that Eichmann succeeded not because he followed orders, but because of his creativity. His new ways of finding ways of expelling Jewish populations, first in Vienna in 1938. His most infamous act was in 1944. In 1944, the sole remaining Jewish population in Europe, or at least the largest, was in Hungary. Some 500,000 people. And Eichmann was sent there as the expert to expel this population to the death camps. And in 1944, his boss, Himmler, realised that Germany was losing the war and began to explore the possibilities of a deal. Could you trade Jewish lives for war material, for trucks? That was never going to work. But the interesting thing is that Eichmann opposed him. He fought him. He tried to undermine him. Far from passively obeying orders, he acted to achieve the end that he believed in, which was the destruction of the Jewish population. After the war, when he was interviewed in Argentina by a Nazi journalist, he regretted what he had done. He regretted he'd only killed 6 million Jews. He said, if we'd killed 8 or 10 million Jews, I would have said, job well done. This was a man who knew exactly what he was doing. This was a man who was not just passively obeying orders. And there's a lovely summary of this. There's more work, incidentally, by Lozovic on Hitler's bureaucrats, which makes similar points about the ways in which the Nazis made sure that the bureaucrats knew what they were doing so they couldn't avoid responsibility, so they were accountable. And yet others, like Kershaw, make the point the whole notion of the Hitler state as an efficient bureaucracy where everybody followed orders misunderstands it. What Hitler did is he set different agencies against each other to compete to achieve vaguely set goals. So they wouldn't unite against Hitler, but they would look to Hitler to give them the authority to achieve what they wanted to achieve. Kershaw talked about working towards the Führer. So the whole notion of simply obeying orders misunderstands the nature of these people, misunderstands the notion of the Hitler state. And as I say, I love this quote. Eichmann in his ilk, not come to murder Jews by accident or in a fit of absent-mindedness, nor by blindly obeying orders. They worked hard, thought hard, took the lead over many years. They were the alchemists of evil. Not the metaphor of easily and helplessly sliding down the slippery slope, but the metaphor of working hard to ascend to the heights of genocide. So I would argue that the historical record is at least more contested, as many of us, especially in psychology, have been led to believe. But now I want to look at the thing I'm qualified to look at, which is the psychology. Because I would argue that if you look at Milgram's own studies, they do not support his explanation. Now, I want to make something clear here. In recent years, there has been a little bit of an industry to debunk Milgram. And some of it is ad hominem. People are trying to say that Milgram, in some sense, hid his results, that he was dishonest, that the phenomena aren't real. Now, if Milgram was a criminal, he was probably one of the most inefficient criminals in history, because, as I previously mentioned, he left a fantastic archive at Yale telling you exactly what he'd done, more than most of us do. You can go back and get transcripts of virtually every condition. You can see all the results. If he was trying to hide anything, then why on earth would he have left all the evidence? My argument is not ad hominem. I have massive respect for Milgram. I think the phenomena he discovered are phenomena of great moment, but I don't accept the explanation. As I say, I'm helped by Milgram in this, because his own evidence tells us why the agentic explanation does not stand up, the agentic state explanation. And the first reason for rejecting it comes back to the fact that, again, as I mentioned previously, he did many variants of these studies. He didn't just do the voice feedback that you read about. He did between 25 and 30 variants. Exactly how many is hard to say, because it's not clear what are pilots and what aren't, but around 25 to 30. And the level of obedience varies from 0% to 100%. If you have no voice feedback, everybody goes to the end. If you have two experimenters who disagree with each other, nobody does. If you make the victim more proximal to the participant, people don't go as far. If you do it in a less prestigious setting, downtown Bridgeport as opposed to Yale University, people don't go as far. Now, the agentic state cannot explain that variability. If we have a propensity somehow to go along with authority, it doesn't explain what any scientific explanation has to explain, which is the variability. So the agentic state can't explain the variability between conditions. That's the first argument. The second argument has to do with one of the details of this study. And here it's important to understand that these studies are beautiful pieces of theatre. They're beautifully choreographed. People are brought into this reality. And Milgram has scripted it very carefully. One of the things he scripts is what the experimenter should do if the participant shows any reticence. If, as nearly everybody does, at some point you say, look, are you sure this should be going on? This guy's screaming. Are you sure he's okay? Milgram scripts what he calls prompts, four prompts, of which only one is a clear order. So the first is a request. Please continue. The second is, if you like, a justification. The science, the experiment, requires you to continue. The third is something of a mixture between the two. It's absolutely essential that you continue. Only the fourth is a clear order. Only the fourth tells you you have no other choice. You must go on. You must go on. Now, if it is true that people are somehow programmed to obey authority, and in particular to obey orders, and that's what most people take from these studies. We've looked at this. Most people see them as telling you that people obey orders no matter how toxic. You would have thought that the fourth of these would be most effective. So let's look at the percentage of people who continue after each of these instructions. 64% after the first, 46% after the second, 10% after the third. Any guesses after the fourth? Anybody want to hazard a guess? You look as if you were about to give me a guess.
Yeah.
What do you reckon? You've seen this talk before, haven't you? I hate people like you in the audience. Zero. Nobody. Every time you give an order, people desist. There's been a replication by Jerry Berger. Finds exactly the same thing. Now, you could argue there's a confound here, there's an order effect. Perhaps by the time we get to the fourth prompt, whatever you said, people wouldn't continue. So we've done a study where we give different prompts in different conditions. And again, the order is least effective. So if it were true that people were attuned to authority, to doing what authority says, to following orders, then it doesn't make sense of why giving an order is the least effective way of getting people to continue. So the nature of the experimenter's voice belies the explanation that Milgram gives. But I think the most important point is this. It's the learner's voice. Now, as I said to you already, I'm a psychologist. I'm not used to looking in archives. And so when we looked in the Milgram archive, and when we found in his own handwriting the instructions for these studies, it's about the nearest thing to a holy relic you will ever find as a psychologist. There was a certain thrift. And this is precisely what, at 150 volts in the voice feedback study, and in many of the other variants, the learner says. Okay, as I said, beautifully scripted, not just for the experimenter, also for the learner. And I will try and act it for you. Ugh, experimenter, that's all. Get me out of here. I told you I had heart trouble. My heart's starting to bother me now. Get me out of here, please. My heart's starting to bother me. I refuse to go on. Let me out. Now, if you were only attending the experimenter, then what the learner says should have no effect on what you do. But Packer did a meta-analysis of the points at which people are most likely to stop. Most likely to stop. And it's the 150-volt point where people are most likely to stop. Also the 300-volt mark where the person makes another and for the first time absolutely explicit demand that they no longer consent to the study. But the learner's voice is being heard. It's not that people are so attentive to the experimenter's voice, they ignore the learner. And I say this is because this is the most important point, because I think it alerts us to something, I think, fundamental about the Milgram paradigm. You see, what is interesting and unique about the Milgram paradigm is that in most psychological studies, we sit people down and we present them with information and we look at how they respond. We put them in a silent world. most unlike the world in which we make everyday decisions. Sometimes in social influence studies we expose them to a particular voice, somebody telling them to do things, and see how they respond to that. A bit better, but again, how often, in anything that counts in this world, do you only hear one voice? On the whole, we live in a multivocal world. Around anything that matters, you will hear multiple voices telling you to do things and incompatible things. You know, the things we study, race, prejudice. Every time I open a newspaper, I'll hear different voices telling me different things about immigration, telling me different things about crime, different things about the economy. And I live and I'm positioned in a multivocal world. And the fascinating and superb aspect of the Milgram paradigm is it's one of the few studies that puts people in a multivocal world, and the agentic state explanation reduces that to a univocal world. Just one voice. It leads us to avoid the real question, which is, why do people listen to one voice over the other? What leads these different voices to have different weights in the different conditions? Now, as I said to you, when you look at Milgram's own notes, they're far richer than the 74 book. And here's one of the diagrams you find in his notes, recognizing the multivocality of the situation. But here we have the experimenter E, here we have the victim W, V, and there we have the subject S. We're in a triadic relationship. And you will find page after page after page with doodles like this, trying to explore the field of forces, trying to understand the relative weights of these different voices and why they might operate in different ways in different conditions. Milgram recognises the richness and multivocal nature of the context, which is all lost in the 74 book. And he even gives us particular understandings of what might be critical. As we went through the archive, occasionally we come across these snippets and we think, God, yes! Bloody hell, we thought we were saying this, and you find it in his notes. This is taken from the archive. He didn't have very good typewriter, did he? And he says, the subjects have come to the laboratory to form a relationship with the experimenter, a specifically submissive relationship in the interests of advancing science. They've not come to form a relationship with the victim, and this lack of relationship in the one direction, and the real relationship with the experimenter in the other produces results. In many ways, he's talking about identification. Do you identify with the science and the scientist as a representative of that science, a legitimate representative, or do you identify yourself as having something in common with the victim? Well, the identification with the scientist dominates because that's why you've come there in the first place. And then he suggests ways of exploring this. And again, if anybody hasn't done a PhD yet, you could get a whole PhD and be very famous simply by doing the studies that Milgram suggests he never did. This is the language of the 1960s. So, like Benedict Cumberbatch, he wouldn't do well if he used this language now. But he makes the obvious point that then perm all the racial relationships between the three parties in terms of black and white. Manipulate those in order to explore how they would impact on relative identification and therefore on how you behave. In many ways, in germ form, in Milgram, is precisely the argument that we put forward. And I say we, I should have said this at the beginning, this is work that I've done all the way through with Alex Hassel. We argue against this notion of, if you like, the mindless bureaucrat, the person who is just looking at their relationship with the experimenter and doesn't realise what we're doing. We talk instead about the engaged follower, and we argue, this is the core argument, very simple, core argument, transformational argument, perhaps. Obedience is not unthinking. Not being a function of unawareness, it's a deliberate identity-based choice between competing voices and competing moral demands. In the Milgram paradigm, obedience flows from identification with a noble scientific cause and with the experimenter as a legitimate scientific authority, over and above an identification with the learner. So how can we study that? How can we find new methods of studying that? Now, one which isn't particularly novel is
archival.
Very simple study that we did. We simply took Milgram's explanations of the different variants, and we gave it to people. And we said, where are you in that situation? Just note down how much you think you would identify with the experimenter, and how much you think you would identify with the learner. Okay, now the black line is the level of obedience. We simply correlate the scores with obedience. Identification with the experimenter, the open dots, follows pretty closely. There's a kind of negative correlation with identification with the learner, but if you take relative identification, identification with the experimenter minus identification with the learner, we get a correlation of about 0.8 between this line and that line. Relative identification seems to at least explain variability. It's a contender. But there are many, many objections. Not least, how the hell do people now know what they would do in a situation to which they've never been exposed? What people think they will do or what people actually do? Two very different things. So we think different things. And so we've been trying to struggle with different ways of getting at toxic obedience in a way that is both sufficiently dramatic to contend with Milgram's findings, which is sufficiently controlled to give us clear conclusions, and which will pass an ethics committee. Mm-hmm. And those three things are difficult to do. So let me explain to you some of the things we've done, each of which has got its problems, but which I think together triangulate to tell a consistent story. The first is we've used virtual reality paradigms. You get people to do a Milgram, but they are not dealing with another person. They are in a virtual reality cave dealing with an avatar. This is work done with Mel Slater at UCL, whose research is to see whether people behave in virtual reality as they do in everyday life. Now again, one of the studies we did was to take up this question of people not attending to the learner. Because our sense was actually, that's far too simplistic. But when you look at what people are doing, when you look at the micro-interactions, actually what you find is people are torn precisely because they want to obey the experiment. They come along to do an experiment. They believe in doing the experiment. They don't want to let down the experimenter, but they don't want to hurt anyone. So how do they square that circle? They try to square that circle as much as they can. And one suggestion is that they do that by helping the learner, trying to get them to get things right so that they don't get too many electric shocks. And they do that by voicing the right answer louder than the wrong answer. So what they do is they give one word in the word pair the person is supposed to learn, and then they give four alternatives. We simply recorded in this virtual reality space the loudness with which they said those four variants. And the evidence we have, and I won't go into too much detail, but in the condition where we stress the scientific importance of this, that after point 12, which is the 12th point where a person demands to be let out, they begin to try and help them a little bit more by giving the right answer a little bit louder. Okay, so the point is, here is a paradigm which allows us to explore these things, and which points yet again to the multivocality of this situation and the fact that people aren't ignoring. They're trying to help both parties as far as they can, but they can't do it forever. They have to come to a choice. A second method we've used, we're very excited about this. We worked with an Australian filmmaker, Catherine Millard, who is a genuine filmmaker. She made Kate Blanchett's first film. She tells when we did this work, we felt two steps from greatness. She tells the story of how Kate Blanchett got the call for Elizabeth while she was on set with Catherine. But the point is that Catherine has devised a method which he calls immersive digital realism. I could go into it, but again, this is not a film study seminar, so I won't. But the basic idea is very simple. You get actors, they're real actors, and you get a professional director who directs them into a character, who is somebody who will be not them, but someone who will be intelligible to them, And then you put that person in a situation. You don't give them a script, you put them in a situation, you just explore what they will do. Okay? And in this case, Catherine directs them into a character and then puts them into a psychology experiment, into a Milgram paradigm. But they're completely naive to it in every other respect. And the argument is that as skilled actors, they can explore how they would behave. They can inhabit, if you like, a particular identity, but they don't have the reflexive problems which cause the real ethical damage, which is that after the study is over, you think, oh God, what does this say about me that I'm prepared to do this because it wasn't you who was doing it? So we take these actors and we put them in a variety of the Milgram paradigms. This is the voice feedback. There are a number of other paradigms that we use, such as two peers rebel, and one of the proximity conditions where you're right next to the person who's getting the electric shocks. Okay. Now, the first thing, again, is we want to explore whether in these paradigms, people behave as they think people will behave, or whether they behave as people actually do in the Milgram paradigm. Well, if they were behaving as people think others behave, one of two things might happen. If they don't know about the studies, they would probably expect that nobody would go that far, so they would stop around 150 volts. If they know the Milgram story, they would believe that people go along, and they would go far further. What we find are very close correlations between how far they go in the various variants and how far they go in immersive digital realism. In other words, there's a pretty close correspondence. What's more, we find all the micro-behaviours, which aren't normally talked about in terms of, you know, people saying the right response louder, in terms of people flicking the switch for a short time, and also the ways they respond to the different prompts. Now, on the one hand, Catherine has made a film. And to us, the film is tremendously exciting. It's a wonderful film that hopefully will help us in terms of generating public debate around Beatles, because what we're trying to do is to revision Milgram. Milgram himself is a great filmmaker. His impact was as much due to his film, Obedience, which he filmed in 1965, as to the academic papers. But in that film, he overrepresents Obedience. We want to allow people to vision disobedience as well as obedience and open up some of the questions that I'm talking to today. So it's a resource in and of itself, but it also provides data, and just this week we published in PLOS some of that data, and what that data shows again is a clear correlation between relative identification and the maximum shock level. Okay, there's a clear identification showing that the more you identify with the experimenter over the learner, the further you actually go in these studies. So we think it's a pretty good study. I would point out there are practical difficulties. To film this properly costs us £100,000 in a week for 20 subjects, so I'm not suggesting you can use it a lot, but for exploring subjects that are otherwise really difficult to explore, I think it's a really interesting and powerful way of doing science, an interesting blend of arts and science. But in many ways, most of the studies we've been doing use a much more traditional type of methodology. And here what we do is we try and use the basic structure of Milgram, of 30 steps, where it gets harder and harder and harder to do something that is harmful to another, and see how far people go. I'll just show you three variants. One is, you're given a picture of a group, and you're asked to choose a word to characterise that group. And people don't like saying nasty things about other groups. All those words are negative. So you've got to choose between dishonest, ignorant, idle, vicious, and egotistical. Now, at the beginning, it's pretty easy. The groups are groups like the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis and... are traffic wardens there? No, they are. Okay. It's quite easy at the beginning. You don't mind saying these things, but it gets harder and harder and harder and harder when you have to talk about nurses or families and so on. People don't like doing this. They're not traumatized. It's not ethically problematic. Our postdoc, Megan, as she did these studies, said she didn't know whether she should be happy or sad because people would tell her how horrible she was to get her to do these studies, so they took it seriously. A second paradigm, okay? Remember the stepwise structure whereby you're doing something that gets harder and harder to do. In this one, you are saying the same things about different groups. It's the fact that the groups get more pleasant that makes it harder to be derogatory. But the other two versions use a more conventional of saying nastier and nastier things to a single group. So the first paradigm is one where allegedly we are looking at the effect of endorsements on people's diet, and people are led to believe that we're giving these endorsements to people, and we are seeing how it affects their food choices. And you start off, you're telling them to eat full-fat yogurt, and the foods gradually get more and more toxic, so you have a toxicity index. Here is the Scottish favourite deep-fried Mars bars, and it gets worse and worse. So how far would you be prepared to go in saying to people, eat these things, they're wonderful for you, knowing full well, actually, they're going to give you a heart attack at best. Some of the others give you cancer and so on. And again, people find these really engaging and quite difficult to do. They're not traumatised. And a third one is allegedly a feedback study. We are telling people we're doing research on the effects of feedback on their performance. And you are given a series, allegedly coming from another person, of responses on a creativity task. And you have to give them feedback that gets worse and worse and worse. So here's an example. Here is the task. Think of a new word for a rainbow. You're told that the participant will give you an answer, sky arch, and then you have to give them feedback, one of those three phrases, and then you give them a score out of 100, and it goes down and down and down. And again, people don't like saying to you, your essay, you might, if they're students here, you might think that academics love saying to you that your essay was complete. I won't be rude, but rubbish. But people find it quite difficult. So it's an online task with the basic structure of doing something and saying something or persuading people to something that's harmful to them, and it gets harder and harder and harder. And then that allows us to use conventional methods of experimentation to look at the effects of different variables. Very simple one. If identification with the science is critical, then if we manipulate and get people to identify more with science, and they want to go further. So we either stress high identification with science, it's a classic sort of paradigm, there's three things that are important about science, like about science, you have in common with science, scientists, or low identification, where you do the opposite. And then you do the task, and what you find is that under conditions of high identification, about 48% go to the end. Under the control, where you don't say anything, which probably is like high identification, because people, after all, have volunteered because they're interested in the scientific study, it's about the same. But under low identification, only 7% of people go to the end. We thought we'd do a cheeky study next, because we thought that if it is true that the notion of science as something worthwhile and noble is what will allow people to harm others in its name, then the more high status the science and the more legitimate the science, the further people should go. So we do exactly the same study, and it either comes from us posing as coming from the Department of Cognitive Neuroscience with brains that light up, or from the fuzzy Department of Social Behaviour. Okay, but exactly the same study, we're asked to do exactly the same thing, either in the name of the Department of Cognitive Neuroscience or in the name of the Department of Social Behaviour. How far do people go? And for neuroscience, 73 go to the end, and for social science, 40%. We're thinking of trying to send this to the journal Science as an act of cheek, with the title of In the Name of Science. But actually, this isn't entirely frivolous, because as people will point out, even Nazi ideology was scientific racism. It was in the scientific name of the good of the race that people could be killed. Now, thank God we don't kill people in the name of race. But do we still think it's legitimate for people to suffer in the name of science? It's not, as I say, not entirely frivolous. And these results, I think, give cause for reflection. We've also begun to do studies where we manipulate identification with the victim. So we take women, and we either get women to focus on the way in which women are discriminated against or we don't. The argument being that when women see themselves as in a sense, victims of discrimination, they will identify more with the victim and don't go as far, and indeed, that's what we find. We're in the midst of many studies exploring these things more. Part of my aim is to give you some answers, and part of the aim is to show you how we are struggling with the ways in which we're going to get at those. But in the minutes remaining, I want to add an extra dimension to the argument. Because I want to make the point that, yes, these people know what they're doing. And yes, people are acting on the basis of which voice they listen to, which is a function of identification. But how does that identification happen? How do people come to identify with one or the other? And again, there's a danger. Psychology sees this as something which kind of just happens. Something which arises out of the relationship between the individual and the environment. But our understanding of the world and where we stand in that world and our identifications never happen like that. There is always a function of leadership trying to position us in particular ways. And I think implicitly you can see those forms of leadership in Milgram's own study, which talk to the various dimensions whereby he constructs an identification with the scientist. He's already acknowledged it. He sets the study up so people come with a particular perspective. But there are many dimensions to the way in which he constructs that relationship of identification. The first is institutional, of course. Yale University, one of the premier universities in the United States, nearly as good in the United States as Cambridge is in the UK, a place where good things are done. When, as I say, he does the study in downtown Bridgeport, where this is supposedly a commercial outfit, people don't know anything like this far. So the very fact it's happening in a particular institutional setting is critical to a sense of people taking part in a noble and legitimate act of science. The second is spatial. Milgram is very aware of the spatiality of identification. At some point early on, he reflects on the spatial arrangements, the spatial relationship between the experimenter, the participant and the learner as being critical. So when the experimenter and the learner are in one room together, they're far more likely to see each other as part of a common group. Simple Gestalt principles, when you look at some of the classic work done in the 50s on entitativity, how groups are formed, the Gestalt principle of spatiality is stressed. So the spatial is a second dimension, which implicitly he explores. He doesn't make this explicit, but implicitly explores in his different conditions. The architectural. I remember reading about fascist architecture and the importance of fascist architecture as being monumental, so the individual is placed as small in relationship to the state and therefore enveloped by the state. If you read Milgram on the design of the shock machine, he was very insistent on, he wanted it to be massive. He wanted it to be blank. He wanted it to have hard, square lines. He wanted it to exude a sense of authority and technical expertise, which again made it more difficult for the individual to question their relationship to it. He had an understanding, if you like, of the architecture of dominance. So there's an architectural dimension. And perhaps most obvious, there's a discursive dimension. The way he talks about the study, all the way through, is critical to these acts of identification. There are discursive moments before the study that are critical. Sorry, I think you could probably read this one. The typewriter was working a little bit better on this debate. So when the participants are having the study described to them before the study, Milgram makes great play of the fact that here is a topic, learning, critical to human progress, about which we know very little, and we're going to do the first truly scientific studies which will lead to human progress. So it's a discourse which binds people into the notion of being part of a progressive enterprise. Actually, we know very little about the effect of punishment on learning, because almost no truly scientific studies have been made of it in human progress. The discursive during the experiment is critical. This takes me back to a point I made earlier. Why is it the fourth prod is counterproductive? Why is it nobody goes along? Well, we would argue again, it has to do with processes of identification. Because if I enlist you as a common enterprise, if I say to you, look, please continue, or I say to you, look, this is important for the science we're both involved in, it's one thing. But as soon as I give an order, I place myself outside you, beyond you, and rather than us jointly doing something we believe in, I'm imposing my will upon yours. Which, as we don't need psychology, only need a small child to realise, tends to lead to reactance, people asserting their autonomy. So it is a rupture of identification to give orders. So the discourses during are critical. And finally, this is another paper that is about to come out after the study. And this relates to the issue of ethics. You know that these studies are ethically completely unacceptable, but why? Why are they ethically unacceptable? On the whole, the notion is that people were harmed by being involved in them, that they were upset and they were enduring problems by being involved in them. In a very famous paper in American Psychologist in 1964, Diana Baumrind makes that point. She says, if I could be convinced that people were okay after the study is okay, they might be acceptable, but surely people would have been harmed by them. And Milgram responds by actually providing evidence which shows actually most people weren't harmed. Most people were fine. Most people were very happy with it. Some weren't. Some people were disturbed. And you might argue, well, it doesn't matter if only one or two were harmed. That's far too many. But the issue of harm is at least open to argument. I think there's another ethical argument, a critical ethical argument, which is the argument of not were they harmed, but why weren't they upset? What made them okay with these studies? And was that, if you like, not individually harmful, but socially harmful? Now, this is what Milgram says to the participants in the debrief he sends to them when all the studies are done. He says the problem with people's authority may well be the crucial issue of our time. The experiments you took part in represent the first efforts to understand the phenomenon in an objective scientific manner. Now, the thing you'll all notice there is how similar that is to what he says before the study. This is a noble enterprise. These are the first scientific studies. It's just now it's not about learning, now it's about obedience. But he's telling people they're taking part in a noble enterprise. Therefore, it's fine that they might have been very stressed. And what are the consequences of showing that? And you can go through the archives and you can look at the comments. And this is what we've done, box 44. You can look at the comments that participants then leave. And they're fascinating. Here's one. After leaving, while driving home, I came to the conclusion that for purposeful reasons I've been hoaxed. Interesting concern developed me as to why. Later, at Yale Med School, I found out. Partial satisfaction. With your report, almost complete satisfaction. Briefly, I was happy to have been of service, the title of the paper that we wrote. Continue your experiments by all means, as long as good can come of them in this crazy mixed-up world of ours. Imagine the violins playing now. Every bit of goodness is needed. But the point is that once you tell people that this is a noble enterprise, that's what makes them fine with it. And what's even more interesting is at that point, people not only say, oh, I'm prepared to take more and more, part in more studies, they say, oh, and I'll tell my friends too as well. So they're prepared to put their friends in a horribly stressful situation for the good of science. So we would argue that the real ethical issue here is that people have been, if you like, sold a discourse, an ideology, which legitimates harm doing in the name of progress. That's the ethical issue. And we think that ethics and psychology, perhaps beyond psychology, have gone in the wrong direction since Milgram, because they look at individual harm, is the individual upset, and ignore social harm, the ways in which particular beliefs are left, which facilitate toxic types of behaviour. So with that, let me come to my conclusions, because my time is up. The first is to reiterate the point that we are not contesting that Milgram shows us something extraordinary, and that he shows that ordinary people, perhaps you or I don't know, if we were put in the right or rather the wrong situation, might commit acts of extraordinary harm. But secondly, we argue, unlike Milgram, this is where we differ, that it's not as if there is a propensity towards conformity. Not that we're somehow programmed to obey orders. Rather, our point is that we make active choices as to whether to prioritise the voice of authority over others. It's an active choice, and I want to stress that because, of course, there's a normative development here. One of the problems about the obeying orders explanation is if you can't help it, you're not accountable. It makes it easier for perpetrators to get away with it. I don't know if any of you have come across the work of Sonken Knightson, Soldaten, where he came across a treasure trove of secret recordings of British intelligence of German prisoners of war during the Second World War. And in these prisoners who don't know they're being recorded, talk about, towards the end of the war, these senior Nazi officers talk about the fact they know they're going to be war crimes trials, and how they're going to respond. And they talk about the fact that, well, look, we could say we were obeying orders, but they know that that will only work as an excuse if everybody comes up with it. So there's almost a conspiracy amongst these people to ground this explanation, which lessens their accountability. Now, that ought to give us pause for thought, at least, about the dangers of such an explanation. So, as I say, it's not just analytically, but normatively as well. I think there are major problems in an explanation which denies choice. We argue that this choice is rooted in a process of identification. Multiple voices, who do you identify with? And we would argue that's true. Actually, I mean, my sense more and more is that human behaviour in general is to be explained much more in terms of the processes of identification with different voices of authority in a multivocal world than the ways we tend to look at it in perceptualist terms. But certainly when it comes to obedience, we would argue which one you listen to. Do you listen to an experimenter who's telling you, shot that person? It's a good thing to do. Science depends upon it. Progress depends upon it. Our ability to get our children to learn depends upon it. Do you listen to that voice? Or do you listen to a voice that says, stop! Don't shock me! Don't hurt me! I'm in pain! I don't accept this! Which voice do you listen to? Who do you identify with? Which morality, as a consequence, becomes predominant? And we argue that this process of identification is not neutral, it's not intrapsychic, it's rooted in a process of mobilisation which must take into account many layers of explanation, from the institutional to the microdynamics of space, of architecture and of discourse. And so my final conclusion is, hopefully, nearly everything you believe about Milgram, including what Milgram himself believed, is wrong. See, a while back I gave a talk in the States, similar to this. And at the end, Sam Gardner came up to me, and Sam talked with Milgram City University, and he said, you know what? He said, I think Stanley would have agreed with everything you say. And to me, that was the greatest accolade we could have, because our aim is not, and I stress this, it's not to debunk. I'm not in the game of debunking. It's not to challenge Milgram and Milgram's status. It's rather to bring out the richness of the explanations, some of which are there in his notes. It's just they become superseded. Sometimes our greatest tragedy is in our success. It's the simple aphorism which reduces complex ideas to a single dimension. That was Milgram's tragedy. He was too good a showman. He came up with too simple an explanation. We lose out the nuance. I should thank many people, because, as you know full well, all intellectual activity is collective, and the tragedy is that credit tends to be individualised, which is quite wrong. Alex Haslam, Alex and I have been working together on these things for a long time. Catherine, who made the film, and Megan, our postdoc, and many students involved in developing some of the paradigms you thought about. If you want to read more, we have some more academic and less academic outputs. There's an article in New Scientist which summarises some of these arguments. There are also some online resources. Oh, this is the film. I shouldn't forget that. This is the film. We're tremendously excited about that. I can think of myself almost as, you know, as a cultured human being. And as I say, whether it will be a success as a film or not, I don't know. I think it's a good film, but I'm not a film critic. Will it be a fantastic resource for debating these issues? I have no doubt about that. And in terms of the third of our transformative aims of generating a debate, we've been talking to a number of institutions about having interdisciplinary workshops tied to a public event where we show the film and have a discussion. And it's the film that gives us our in. And we've arranged one at the new Museum for the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. If you haven't been there, it's an amazing place. We're in discussion with the US Holocaust Museum, with Holocaust museums in Belgium and Cape Town and Sydney. So this, we hope, will be really powerful for us in engendering that debate. The online resources, in particular, most of our Milgram papers are on this site, www.bbcprisonstudy.org, which started off in relationship to an earlier piece of research that Alex and I did, revisiting Zimbardo's famous Stanford Prison study. That, when you ask students, is the second most famous psychology study of all time. But the Milgram papers are all there. So if you want to find the papers, you'll find them there. And that's it.